The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Georgine Rice. This week, finally, after nearly 50 years, the word so many of us have been waiting to hear from the Supreme Court, the Constitution does not confer a right to abortion. Roe and Casey are overruled. We'll hear from pro-life leader Abby Johnson.
We have more states that will ban abortion and make it illegal than we have states making it legal.
Ryan Anderson points us to the priorities in the days ahead.
We need to bear witness to the truth that every human being is made in the image and likeness of God.
We'll look at the significance of the current conservative majority in the Supreme Court, including the win of Coach Kennedy in Washington, who simply wanted to pray.
This is the most significant term of the Supreme Court in our recent lifetimes.
And a victory for the Second Amendment in a case coming out of New York.
It's great to see we have a Supreme Court that's willing to follow the law wherever it may take them.
We've got all this and more. I'm Georgine Rice, and I'm glad to be with you once again. I'm coming to you from Portland and my home station of KPDQ. You can hear my program live each weekday afternoon on 93.9 FM here in Portland and online via our website at kpdq.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. We'll begin and end with the U.S. Supreme Court. The decisions that have been released in these past few weeks are some of the most important and consequential decisions the court has made in decades. And that's particularly true if you're motivated by the actual text of the Constitution. We'll begin with the case we've all been closely watching, the Dobbs case, and the words it's hard to believe actually came from a 6-3 majority of the U.S. Supreme Court. In this historic decision, the majority held, and I quote, "The Constitution does not confer a right to abortion. Roe and Casey are overruled, and the authority to regulate abortion is returned to the people and their elected representatives." We'll begin with Ryan Anderson. He's the co-author of a new book on abortion titled Tearing Us Apart. He joined Kevin McCullough, my colleague in New York City, on AM 570, The Mission.
Your reaction to the decision as it was handed down, it seemed like Mr. Alito went to great length to really give as sound a denunciation of the logic, rationale, and execution of Roe v. Wade as one could possibly have hoped for.
That's exactly right. I mean, this is exactly what so many people have spent so many years laboring for. It's not the end of the pro-life movement. It's, you know, it's the first step. The first step was admitting we got Roe wrong, we got Casey wrong. And now the court has done that. And Alito, just in a masterful opinion, explains why there's no foundation in the Constitution for a right to lethal violence in the womb, the right to kill an unborn child. And then he explains away all of the various stare decisis arguments. You know, he's not overturning the principle of stare decisis. He says that those considerations don't apply in this case. He goes through, you know, five different reasons why, about the unworkability of Roe and Casey, about it being egregiously wrong, about it having severe consequences. I mean, for example, the death of a human being. I mean, if ever there were an occasion to say, look, we got it wrong and we're not just going to keep getting it wrong for stare decisis reasons, we're actually going to admit we got it wrong.
What's the fabric of the country going to go through in the days to come from where you sit?
It's torn apart and it's tearing apart the body politic. And you know, whether in the, you know, days and weeks after the leak, you know, the assassination attempt on Justice Kavanaugh, the vandalization of pregnancy resource centers, the firebombing of pregnancy resource centers, the churches that were attacked, those are just the most recent instances of this. And obviously the reaction to the opinion itself, the cause for violence, the night of rage, et cetera, et cetera. It's incredibly unfortunate. It's something that should be condemned by everyone, left, right, and center, whether you're pro-life or pro-choice. And so I think part of it, you know, where do we go from here is that we need to be able to persuade each other. We need to be able to explain why we believe what we believe to people who don't already agree with.
Do you believe that there is a role for people of faith in that conversation in a significant way?
Of course. I mean, not only is there a role, but I would say it's a primary, it's a central role. I think what we need to do is we need to bear witness to the truth that every human being is made in the image and likeness of God. We need to bear witness to the basic biological truth that a new human being comes into existence at the completion of fertilization, at conception, that that ultrasound image that we're seeing, that's a real live human being. We need to bear witness to the truth that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and that amongst these is the right to life. I mean, this is right baked into the American founding, the Declaration of Independence. And I think people of faith have an obligation to bear witness of these truths and to show that it's not just faith-based, that faith and reason go together, scripture and science go together, because all truth is from the same source. These are all creational truths.
There are a lot of people that have a lot of misconceptions about what's going to happen now, and the media have not been helpful, and certainly politicians have not been helpful. Even people like the Speaker of the House doesn't understand the difference in actually espoused rights in the Constitution and things that have been sort of inventively shoved in there. It's going to require a lot of conversation. Do you think that the political and social and cultural left are going to allow this conversation to unfold?
Yes and no. I think some on the political and cultural left are going to stand in the way. And so it's going to be very important for conservatives to partner with those on the political and cultural left who do want to have the conversation in a civil way. I think it's a mistake to paint the left as a monolith, right? And in the same way that,
especially
like,
in this day and age. Yeah.
Yeah. In the same way that Ruth Bader Ginsburg doesn't speak for all women, we shouldn't allow the most radical extreme elements of the left claim a monopoly of speaking on behalf of the political left. And so conservatives need to partner with reasonable and responsible liberals and have this conversation. And then we all need to condemn the extremists who are terrorizing the country.
As we look ahead, there's no question that the landscape of the nation on the issue of abortion has changed dramatically. And that landscape will differ greatly from state to state. Abby Johnson is a former director of Planned Parenthood, who is today a bold and courageous defender of life. Abby was also a guest of Kevin McCullough.
I think there are 13 or 15, it's something like that, trigger states that had immediate bans that went into effect. So abortion is now no longer in those states immediately upon the Roe decision coming down. I think another 26 have some sort of process, whether it's legislative affirmation or a governor's signature or something along those lines that have to happen. But there are a number of other, a couple of dozen more states, they're going to be moving in that direction. I think that puts the number at about 40 or 41 states. That means there's going to be 9 where abortion is still going to be as prevalent and maybe even more in demand than it was before the Roe overturn of the Dobbs case. Your thoughts on where we stand in the aftermath of this?
Yeah, it's certainly exciting. It's an exciting time. People have been, you know, like you mentioned, fighting for this for so long. You know, many people longer than I've even been alive have been fighting against this horrific law. And, you know, we are looking at 26 states that currently have either a trigger ban or have a constitutional amendment or something in their state constitution that makes abortion illegal right now in their state. And like you said, there are many other states that have something proposed in their state to make abortion illegal.
Right.
And then there are, you know, other states. I think it's going to be sort of a pendulum swing one way or the other. So we're going to see, you know, sort of deep red states, right, where abortion is completely illegal, or we're going to see deep blue states where abortion is completely illegal for any reason through all 9 months of pregnancy, where Roe is sort of codified in an extreme way.
Right.
So, you know, that's what we have seen happen in Colorado. That's what we've seen happen in California. In California, even going an additional step, Newsom saying that, you know, California is going to be a sanctuary state for abortion, and him signing into law, $125 million of state taxpayer money going to fund abortion tourism for his state so that other women can come there and have their abortions paid for. So, I mean, it's going to be, I think, one way or the other, sort of a pendulum swing one way or the other. But right now in our country, we have more states that will effectively ban abortion and make it illegal than we have states making it legal, which yeah. is, I mean, a huge victory.
Well, I was adding up the math. I mean, you know that I don't have to tell you this, but Planned Parenthood alone does nearly 400,000 abortions a year.
Correct.
In a lot of states, they're out of business now, and they right. will be very, very soon. And I'm curious, how does the pro-life message and the championing of God-given life now change for those people that have been in this discussion and this debate for such a long time? Because the focus has been, let's get a case to the court that can overturn Roe. Now it's like right. we need 50 different teams of fighters to go into every state and make sure that the laws protect babies at this point. And I think that in some ways it's going to get it's going to be so decentralized. I fear it may not remain as strong as it is to fight for life.
Yeah, so that is definitely a concern, Kevin. So that, I mean, that is a concern of mine. That's something that I've been talking about, is that the pro-life movement has gained so much momentum, sort of rallying around this idea that we have to overturn Roe at the federal level. And, you know, my fear is that now that we have done just that, that there's going to sort of be this complacency or apathy, particularly in these deep red states, right? That places like Texas that have a trigger ban, places like Tennessee, where we know abortion is going to be illegal, that people in the pro-life community in those states are going to go, oh, great. Okay. Well, my work is done, right? And now I can move on to something else. But the reality is that truly in the pro-life movement, our work is just beginning
yeah.
at the state level. And we're going to see abortion clinics close for sure, which means, but it doesn't mean that women are no longer going to have crisis pregnancies, right?
Right.
Just because abortion clinics close doesn't mean that women aren't going to be getting pregnant.
Well, and that's why,
and saying, now what do I do?
And that's why Antifa is attacking crisis pregnancy centers, because they
right.
know that they are the ones that are going to outlive this.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, pregnancy centers are now a super threat to the left, right? And so, you know, we need to be doubling down on our support of pregnancy resource centers, maternity homes. And yes, I mean financial support, but also I mean volunteerism, donating supplies, you know, working for them. What, you know, what are we doing to actually support these centers? You know, have you toured your local pregnancy center? Find out what they do. Know where they are.
Hmm.
You know, are you putting information about your local pregnancy center on your social media? You know, we need to be really championing these centers and letting people know about all the awesome services that they offer, because crisis pregnancies will continue to exist.
Coming up, a victory for the football coach in Washington who simply wanted to pray.
This is the most significant term of the Supreme Court in our recent lifetimes.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy enters our 25th anniversary year, we've remained committed to a single truth of world history, that ideas have consequences. To understand these ideas and their impact on today's politics, and to test them quantitatively, requires the unique curriculum we offer on our Malibu, California campus. Apply now for fall classes at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. As the Supreme Court closes this term, their decision in Dobbs is surely the highest profile decision, but it was by no means the only decision of consequence coming out of the high court. In a case coming out of Washington State, football coach Joe Kennedy ended up in front of the Supreme Court because he had the temerity to pray in public, where everyone could see him after each of the team's football games. And he won. And with him, the free exercise and free speech clauses of the First Amendment. Matt Staver of the Liberty Council joined Don Crow, my colleague, on WAVA in Washington, D.C.
Talk to us a little bit about whether this represents a more conservative court from now on out into the perhaps the near future, at least.
Oh, for sure. No question about that. And in fact, if you look at these decisions this term, this is the most significant term of the Supreme Court in our recent lifetimes. And we're 5-0. And it begins on May the 2nd. And that's with our case, Shurtleff versus City of Boston. We won it 9-0, involving the Christian viewpoints censorship, involving, in that case, the Christian flag. I said then that our case would form the foundation of today's decision with regards to Coach Kennedy. I'll come to that in just a moment. So that was the first one. Then we had a win with regards to the voucher case involving Christian schools in Maine. Then we had the Second Amendment win last week. Then we had the win on abortion, a huge win. Then today we have the win with Coach Kennedy, a 6-3 decision. In that Coach Kennedy case, they cited our Shurtleff case, Liberty Counsel's case involving the Christian flag in the city of Boston, cited it as another argument for overturning the so-called Lemon Test, which was invented by the judges going back to 1971, has done a tremendous disservice and harm to the interpretation of the First Amendment Establishment Clause, the so-called church-state issue, to try to eliminate certain kinds of things like religious viewpoints or speech. And in fact, in our case in Shurtleff, they tried to argue Establishment Clause and they tried to argue the Lemon Test. In the Kennedy case, they tried to argue, well, the school has to censor Coach Kennedy because if they don't censor Coach Kennedy in the private prayer, it will be an Establishment Clause under Lemon. But today, Lemon is dead and buried. It goes back to 1971. We've argued on that. We've written briefs on that issue for years. Today, it came to pass. And the court now says they're going to take, guess what? Imagine this, a more historical review and consideration of the First Amendment Establishment Clause. Well, that's what they should have been doing from the very beginning. What does the text say? What was the meaning of the text? Let's apply it now to this series of facts. That's a result of today. So you have the Shurtleff case on May the 2nd, and now you have the Kennedy case, and they're kind of bookends, so to speak. You have huge victory for religious free speech, Shurtleff. Religious free exercise and free speech, that's Kennedy with the Coach Kennedy case. And an elimination of this judge-made establishment clause Lemon Test that goes back to 1971. Then on Friday, what you have is this incredible case on abortion that strikes down all these abortion precedent that were horrible, never based in the Constitution. And then last week, you also have an historical overview, guess what, of the Second Amendment. So the First, the Second Amendment, and the Constitution in general, it has been a tour de force this term, 5-0 on these critically important cases that will have generational impact. And, for example, on these cases, these are the cases that law school students will now read in constitutional law class. They're not going to be reading Roe and Casey anymore on abortion. They're going to read Dobbs. They're not going to be reading Lemon. They're going to be reading Shurtleff in the Kennedy case. And they're not going to be reading some of these other bad decisions on the Second Amendment. They're going to be reading Justice Thomas's decision last week.
We'll continue on that last case that Matt mentioned. The case is New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin. And the pattern that I hope you see emerging is that this court is pointing us back to the words and the text of the Constitution. Mark Smith of King's College joined me on my program here on KPDQ.
It's great to see we have a Supreme Court that's willing to follow the law wherever it may take them. And that is a breath of fresh air compared to what we've seen in the last few decades.
Well, let's go back and talk about the case that ultimately resulted in this decision, New York Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin. The question was whether or not a gun carry permit required that officials in New York deem the individual worthy of or having had a sufficient reason for a carry permit. Can you elaborate on that just a bit?
Sure. So in the United States, you have 43 states that say that we respect the right to carry a gun. So either you, as long as you're a law-abiding citizen and you're not a prohibited person under federal law, meaning you're a felon or something like that, then once you meet an objective criteria, you are allowed to carry a handgun loaded in public to defend yourself, your family, and your community. That's the law in 43 states right now. But there are these other outlier states, which include some of the big ones like New York, California, New Jersey, Maryland, Massachusetts, Hawaii, where they have what's called a may issue permitting scheme. What that means is the only way you are allowed to carry a handgun in public is if you go to the government, the state government, and you say, "Mother, may I please carry a gun?" And they will allow you to carry a gun if they think you are special. If you are just an ordinary person that wants to protect yourself and your family using a firearm in public, they're like, that's not good enough. You need to have a special reason. A special reason might be you're a celebrity. A special reason might be you're a politician and risk of life because of that. A special reason might be that you're a victim of a stalker or something like that. But you have to demonstrate a special need historically in these states to have a carry permit to be allowed to carry a gun in public. This Supreme Court decision today, NYSERPA versus Bruin, said that those six states that have these may issue permitting schemes where you have to beg the state for permission to carry a gun is unconstitutional under the Second Amendment. Because it's a constitutional right, you don't have to beg the state to exercise your right. You have that right to exercise it, and the state cannot stand in the way.
Now, Clarence Thomas went on to say that while there is nothing illegal about America's existing state-level permitting systems, those systems may not be mere smokescreens for outright prohibition, unequal protection, or unacceptable delay. We do not rule out. So the decision wasn't saying that you can't impose a system in which if you're a felon, you can't have a gun, that there are certain standards that apply to everyone. But they cannot randomly, as you've described, deprive Americans of the right to carry a weapon if they don't have an imminent threat against them.
That's right. The presumption is in a free society that you are allowed to do it unless it's banned. Because we have the Second Amendment that guarantees a right to keep and bear arms, recognizing the pre-existing human right of self-defense, we are allowed to exercise that right until we have forfeited that right by virtue of bad behavior, meaning you've committed a felony and have lost your gun rights along those lines. But Justice Thomas in today's decision made it very clear that the presumption in the United States is that you have the right to carry a gun, and they made it very clear. And I should mention, this is important, Georgine, it's a 6-3 decision, and all six justices made it clear, and they, even though there was a couple concurrences, they all agreed with this one critical point, that the burden of proof to show that a gun control law is constitutional lies heavily with the state, with the government, as opposed to the way the cases have been over the last decade, which is basically the people suing on behalf of gun rights really bore the burden to show that they had a right to have a gun. But now they've shifted the burden dramatically to the state to say, you have to come up with a historical basis to show that your gun prohibition, your gun restriction is somehow based in American history, and it's some sort of traditional rule that we've seen for 200 years. And if you can't do that, then we're not going to really uphold that gun control law going forward.
Coming up,
in their attempt to destroy it, radical Republicans are charging ahead with their crusade to criminalize health freedom.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. It's a look at today's most compelling stories and provides responses from key conservatives in media and politics. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. As I mentioned earlier, the national landscape on abortion has changed dramatically. For nearly 50 years, the legal battle of the pro-life movement has ultimately focused on one objective, the overturn of Roe versus Wade. Yes, the movement pressed for incremental gains in other related areas, but the prize had always been Roe. So, now what? Our friends at Focus on the Family did a program looking in exactly that direction, looking to the future. Joining Jim Daly, Albert Moeller, and Helen Alvarez of George Mason University.
How are you feeling today with the news of Roe being overturned?
We understand this is the beginning of an even bigger battle. But we've, by God's grace, earned the right to enter those battles at the congressional level, where it will undoubtedly have to be fought out, and at all 50 states. The reality is that Justice Alito got right to the heart of the issue when he wrote that from the day Roe v. Wade was handed down, it was on a collision course with the Constitution. Huh. And, you know, as a Christian theologian and as a constitutionalist, I just want to point out that every wrong method of treating the scripture has a parallel in a wrong method of dealing with the Constitution. And, you know, liberal theology has basically abandoned the scripture, and liberal jurisprudence sought basically to abandon the Constitution. The majority of the court pulled us right back to the text of the Constitution. And for that, we should be very thankful.
The work is not over. That's one of the concerns I've had. This simply puts it back in the hands of all the states. So if you think about the spiritual battleground, now it goes from a federal level to a state level. I would hope eventually, even if Congress tries to develop a law that gives a woman the right to an abortion in the future, that this event will create the desire not to do that, that the immorality of taking a child's life because of finances or whatever, that it's never worth it to murder a child for the benefit of that person's future. Let me play a clip from Speaker Pelosi and get your reaction to her.
This morning, the radical Supreme Court is eviscerating Americans' rights and endangering their health and safety. But the Congress will continue to act to overcome this extremism and protect the American people. Today, the Republican-controlled Supreme Court has achieved their dark, extreme goal of ripping away a woman's right to make their own reproductive health decisions. American women today have less freedom than their mothers. With Roe and their attempt to destroy it, radical Republicans are charging ahead with their crusade to criminalize health freedom.
Al, let's go to you first. Your response to that rationale, that this is an extreme moment, that the judges are extreme. How do you react to that?
Well, they're so extreme, they're in line with 187 years of American jurisprudence before Roe v. Wade. In other words, the progressives in this great cultural divide, I think, just assuming they're honest, they honestly believe that human rights are invented by human beings to be politically negotiated to whatever extreme you can politically get away with. Their understanding is that history is unfolding so that the next thing you know, from abortion, LGBTQ rights, especially the T and all the rest, don't forget the plus sign at the end of that. This is a court decision that just effectively refutes the entire logic of their case. So I guess predictably, they're pretty upset.
Right. And I think, Helen, for me, that use of the word extreme, it seems odd that for us, the pro-life community, trying to preserve life, encourage a mother to get through her pregnancy, to make the right decision, a decision she'll never regret, in my opinion, that somehow we're the extremists because we don't support the killing of children. Maybe you can explain that to me.
That is a political partisan statement. And it's so far removed from the question of the humanity, that mother and that child in an abortion facility. It is so far removed from the opinion itself, which is a product of 49 years of fabulous scholarship. The pro-life movement didn't sit around and stamp its feet and say, "You're so bad. Why can't you see the unborn child as valuable?" They wrote books and had symposia and wrote amicus briefs and scholarly articles. And this is the fruit of them. And they're true. To actually say truthful things like, if liberty in the Constitution is the American experience and all the laws that were passed in the states and what they show about who we are, then a country that banned abortion for 200 years doesn't include it as a liberty. Reason and truth are beautiful. And that opinion, if you read it with that view, is that. And I feel happy because I saw something true and because someone is actually reading the Constitution as if it was the people's document and it doesn't just belong to five justices.
Coming up,
this is going to be an ongoing battle from year to year.
More from Focus on the Family, Albert Mohler, and Helen Alvarez when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Stay with us.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy enters our 25th anniversary year, we've remained committed to a single truth of world history, that ideas have consequences. To understand these ideas and their impact on today's politics, and to test them quantitatively, requires the unique curriculum we offer on our Malibu, California campus. Apply now for fall classes at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. In the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the legal picture on abortion has shifted from a contrived constitutional right to abortion to a federalist approach. 50 states and 50 distinct approaches. But the question remains, will we see lives saved today since the fall of Roe? Well, that's a question many are asking. Let's return to more from Focus on the Family's Jim Daly with Albert Mohler and Helen Alvarez of George Mason University.
Dr. Mohler, let me turn to you. You recently cited new data from the Guttmacher Institute that indicates abortion has been on the rise in recent years after a 30-year decline. In fact, the New York Times reported in 2020 that 1 in 5 pregnancies were ending an abortion. That's a shocking number. How do you think the court's decision will impact those numbers? Are we going to see fewer abortions, obviously, or will these blue states that, like Colorado, I'm sad to say, our home state, they want to be an abortion tourist destination? So what do you think the outcome will be?
Well, in one sense, I think we're going to find ourselves in two Americas, but it's going to be more like three. And so this is my analysis. I think there are others who would clearly agree with it. There are some deeply blue states, Illinois, Rhode Island, California, Massachusetts, that are going to be abortion destinations. I mean, Gavin Newsom in California is talking about paying women to come to California to have abortions paid for by the state. You go to a state like Alabama, it's the opposite. State like Mississippi, from which the Dobbs case came. Or a state like Louisiana, where even a Democratic governor actually voted for a restriction on abortion just to recent days. Mm. So those are two different Americas, but there's a third America. And that third America includes states, and I'd put Colorado a bit there, where it's still possible to look at potential restrictions on abortion, but we've got a long way to go to get to any elimination of abortion. One thing we can do, we can be there to foster children, adopt children, do whatever we can to help mothers in crisis. And so the political battles is going to be very uneven, and I do divide it into that trio, the deep blue states that I think may get even bluer, the deep red states that may get even redder in that sense. And then at least somewhere between 10 and 20 states where this is going to be an ongoing battle from year to year. But I don't want to take too much time here. But the bigger issue, I think the president and Speaker Pelosi made very clear that they want to push for national legislation. And ultimately, I think both sides know that's where the big debate will head.
Right. And Helen, from a legal perspective, when you look at that, that's kind of what the court has often said, especially the originalists. The court should not get involved in these deep social issues. The legislative branch should determine a law and, if possible, pass that law. Then it'll be challenged. And then the court will look at it to say, is that law that Congress passed, is it constitutional? That's kind of how the government is supposed to work. And this is one of the difficulties that we've had, where the progressives have used the court often to get laws through, in essence, get laws through court decisions. Is that fair?
Yes, but I want to sound a note of hope. And it is about the feds. States have legislative authority that's called the police power. Any law for health, safety, welfare. They used to also say morals, but that kind of went by. Yeah. So any law in that area, the states can do. The federal legislative branch, Article 1 of the Constitution, gives supposedly pretty limited powers to a federal Congress. Most were reserved to the states. The feds can do things like interstate commerce, you know, raise and support an army, tax and spend, take care of federal lands. So they can't actually pass a law that just says abortion is legal in the 50 states, because it doesn't fit any of those Article 1 powers. But here's what they can do, and you've seen them do. They can claim that something they're doing affects interstate commerce. Oh, abortion affects interstate commerce. We're going to make a law about something on abortion that affects interstate commerce. We're going to give federal money to the states, but not unless you allow unlimited abortion. We're going to let federal contractors build planes, you know, supply healthcare, but not if you don't provide free abortion for all your employees. We're going to make sure that every federal land has an abortion clinic on it. They're going to go nuts with the Article I powers they have. They can't straightforwardly legalize abortion in the 50 states. But they can use all these Article I powers and they can slip through various, you know, supposed limits in them. And again, think of how what a sick agenda this is. Instead of all the things this country needs right now, we're going to be take our Article I powers and slip abortion in wherever we can. Again, when you think about the abortion process itself, it's a sick agenda.
What do we do? How do we move forward? How do we get into discussions with people?
Yeah, I'll make one broad point. Obviously, I think all of the effort to welcome women being able to bring children into the world and to make them feel that they can do justice to the child, justice to their financial necessity, et cetera, crucial. But I think that the right of abortion has been sold on the right of autonomy, the right just to make my own decisions, whatever. I think that reinstating the idea that we are in relationship first. We are first God's children, and then we are brothers and sisters to one another, and that we owe one another. I do think that all of those things are going to have to be theologically and morally and philosophically and culturally affirmed. Autonomy is gonna beat help that we can provide if we don't do that.
Yeah. Dr. Moeller, let me pitch this to you and get your response. And same open question, how do we move forward? But I was at a pro-life event not long ago. A woman was on the podium and she said, you know, the Judeo-Christian ethos is that Christ showed us that we were to love the Lord our God with all of our heart, soul, and mind, and to love our neighbor, and that the greatest sacrifice a person could make is to lay their life down for another. And she turned that on the abortion issue and said, now we are asking the baby to lay its life down for the mother. And it's a real twist on the Christian ethic of how you give and sacrifice to where it becomes somewhat selfish.
You know, in a society that's increasingly secularizing and, you know, worshiping autonomy, abortion becomes almost sacramental. The gift of life is consistent throughout any civilization that survives. The understanding that every single human life is precious and is to be defended. And abortion is not just about the numbers of babies aborted every year. It's about the moral corruption of the American heart and mind in such a way that makes all life diminished and expendable and contingent.
Coming up, the fallout of Roe.
Nearly 50 years of legal abortion in this country and in our state has corrupted our institution.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. As we approach the close of our program, I'd like to express a word of thanks to the heroes in this fight for the dignity of unborn human life. To the men and women who were absolutely relentless for the cause of life and the overturn of Roe versus Wade, when no one really believed it could actually happen. To those who marched and who prayed and donated their time, their talents, and their resources for this God-honoring cause. To those who worked in the crisis pregnancy centers, giving tangible help and hope to women in need. Thank you. Among those heroes of the cause, I want to thank a local hero, Lois Anderson, Executive Director of Oregon Right to Life, right here in my home state. Lois joined me on my program. How do you see Oregon Right to Life moving forward in support of the sanctity of human life?
It's a new beginning for us, but it's the beginning of a long road. Nearly 50 years of legal abortion in this country and in our state has corrupted our institutions, from medicine to legal institution to political and government. It will not be a quick process to undo that. Here in Oregon, we're going to be educating people about the humanity of the unborn child about abortion procedures and why it is wrong, and also working on legislation that we, through our research over time, has shown that a majority of Oregonians support, which is limiting late-term abortions. That's what we're going to continue to do. We want to be approaching this issue with love and with peace and seeking consensus, not with conflict and rage. And I think part of that has to be acknowledging where Oregonians are at in their view of where they want to protect unborn children. And we want to work to start there.
For all of us, particularly those who are pro-life and happen to also be Jesus followers, it's very important not only that we get the issue right, but that we are right in the way we approach the issue, that we have the right attitude. And that can be something of a challenge when opponents are announcing their rage. But I'm grateful that because we support life, that we approach it in a way that respects all life, whether it's in the womb or outside of the womb, and people with whom we have strong disagreement.
That's true. I mean, I think that's the only way that we can approach things. What is more loving than protecting an innocent unborn baby? And we need to also be showing love and care for mothers. Pregnancy resource centers around Oregon, maternity homes, churches, other civic organizations, they have been doing this for years. They have been walking alongside women who are unsupported in their pregnancies for years, and they're going to continue to do it. And I challenge every pro-life person, believer, Jesus follower listening today, if you're not engaged in your community with an organization that supports pregnant women, do it.
Thank you for joining us for the Christian Outlook. Let me wish you all the best on this 4th of July weekend. Enjoy the celebration of freedom. Enjoy the time with your family. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers David Pouchon, Mike Cook, Alex Perez, and James Blend, I'm Georgine Rice. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.